This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Welcome to Pizza Quest. I'm Peter Reinhardt, a man on a never-ending search for the perfect pizza. This show is the audio version of the Pizza Talk YouTube series, where I engage in interesting conversations with some of the country's greatest pizza makers and other artisans. Thanks for joining me on this quest. Today we have John Gudekans from Athens, Ohio, Avalanche Pizza, but well-known beyond that as a world champion pizza maker, as a contributor to Pizza Today magazine. You're everywhere. You're ubiquitous because at the Pizza Expos, you're a host, you're a MC, you're a competitor, you're everything, and also extremely creative. And I love your site. What is it? The Pizza Goon is your blog. And why don't you tell us a little bit about how that came about, and maybe for those people who don't know you, because a lot of our viewers are not people who get to go to Pizza Expo, tell us a little bit about your journey, into the pizza world and how you became the pizza goon.
Well, thank you. Flattery will get you everywhere, Peter. I'm really honored to be on your show. I've read all your books and I continue to read them.
Thank you. We're honored to have you here.
Let's see what Peter did. Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm going to do that. I started out actually in the fine dining area. I was a dishwasher in an Italian place at 14 years old. And I keep going back to that. It was Bimbo's Italian restaurant. There's three brothers. They're from Lecce. And Bimbo was my hero. Tall guy, slick back hair. The head dishwasher was an old guy who smoked a cigar. No air conditioning, 104 degrees, and I had my three compartment sink and I would do dishes in it. And it amazed me because it looked like lobster bisque, but these dishes would come out sparkling, and because I'd never changed the water. But the head dishwasher's name was Mouse, and he called me Weasel. He had a name for everybody, and it was quite a trip. Anyway, Bimbo really, he was stern and strict, one thing in particular, he used to bring the tomatoes over to the sink. He made me clean the sink out. He'd come with a colander and he would take his time, almost meditatively. He'd say, "Esce, esce, esce." And I'm like, "What does esce mean?" This means get the hell out of the way, So I would pull over the can and he would go through each can, each tomato. And he would say, "You never let anyone see your seeds in your sauce. Never let anyone see seeds in your sauce." And that just, it really stuck with me, always use the best ingredients, et cetera. After that, I've been in restaurants my whole life, hamburgers, ice cream places. And then I went into the Navy for 5 years and we flew off the coast of Soviet Union, North Korea, China, as a cryptologist. And then I came back into a country club and they automatically made me sommelier. And I was like, what's a sommelier? And they just showed me the wine cellar, this dank, dark wine cellar. All the labels were off the bottles. I didn't know what the hell it was. So
it's like your destiny had been stamped on you at the age of 14, which seems to be a critical age for so many people that we're talking to. 14 was a very crucial age, I think, for kind of foreshadowing what was to come.
Yeah, and that's I think that age bracket, and when I bake pizzas with kids, it's that age bracket where they start to, they get that creativity that I can make something. People aren't telling me anything. I did this, and it's really important. After that, I went to Chicago, and I was at Liceo Bleu for a while, and I started as a waiter and gravitated to a manager, and we had Paul Bocuse there, Elton John. In fact, I couldn't even watch Elton's movie because I'm like, no, you were a jerk. But he was, and Gregory Zifchek, who's now the president of CIA, he was a nice guy, except he called me John Dory all the time.
John Dory.
But after that,
you're going to call me a fish.
Yes, exactly.
But so, cut it out like your food.
Oh, he hated the chef. He called him the frog. He kept sending back his lamb chops. In fact, I couldn't tell the chef anymore. He was the chef Dominique 14, I think his name was. And he came out, he had his knife ready because Elton kept, he had this Robin Hood hat on with this hugest feather. And we had to move the tables away from him. And it was after a concert and he kept calling him that stupid frog in the kitchen.
Brits in the fridge have kind of a thing, you know?
Yes, I think so. But he tipped me $600, so that was fine, you know. And
hey, he's your guy.
He's my man. I can be bought, yes.
I love it.
Yeah, so that was a lot of fun. It was really neat because that's when I just started tableside. And, you know, it's just, you know, I had a guy named Gaetano Fugazzato, Sicilian, looked like Richard Gere, and he taught me how to do everything. He said, you know, his motto was, a no dog barks at a rich man. And to this day, there are so many facets of that saying. Like a rich man he'd be driving down, he wouldn't be walking down the road, you know, stuff like that. But his premise was, if you're going to do something in front of someone, make it look good, make it look like you meant to. Even if you're going to steal from someone, look them in the eye while you're picking their pocket, you know. And this guy... He'd sit there and he'd do a shot of Louis XIII with a packed house of, and I was his front waiter, and I'm just like, Gaetano, come on, we got to, you know, I got to do this mushroom thing over at the table over here. And he's like, don't worry. And so that was a lot of fun. And then I gravitated to Entree New Restaurant, which is at the Fairmont Hotels, and Richard Swig, I don't know if you remember him.
Just beautiful.
His whole thing was keeping the guests in the hotel. So he had these outlets. I remember one of them was crazy. We went to in this San Francisco, the Tonga Room, and I thought, "Oh, this is going to be so cheesy," but it was a good cheese, man.
You were at the Fairmont in San Francisco, John. You were in the one in San Francisco, the Fairmont.
Yeah, we visited there. I was the one in Chicago.
Oh,
so
okay.
But yeah, they had a big pool in the middle, and every half an hour, the band would come out on a. on a raft, and it would rain, and you're under these Polynesian little huts eating, and it was just hilarious. It was so, and all these old people were doing the snake dance, dun 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 dun. You know, it just brought you back to the 30s or 40s. But
are the days that Trader Vic's was one of the big, you know, Polynesian kind of restaurants too.
I remember that, yeah, with the big drinks with the, you know, pineapple.
So you really, a lot of your culinary roots are in the Chicago area before you moved into Ohio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a lot of tableside service, just from flambés to smoked salmon and Caesar salads. I'd get weeded with, you know, I have to do 20 Caesar salads at three different tables, and they'd bring me out all the lettuce in a giant tablecloth. I just, you know, just try and make my way through that. But and then I went to moved to.
I'm gonna have to have your Caesar salad one of these days because that's still my favorite food of all time is Caesar salad made tableside. I can never get enough of it when it's done well.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And in fact, I still train guys here. You know, they cut off the stems. I'm like, do you know there's restaurants that only serve the stems of romaine? You know that, right? And wow, why would they do that? You know. But then
nuggets that you've picked up over the years, you know, no seeds in the sauce, you know, look them in the eye, whatever the other, all those little
romaine stems
save the stems.
Yeah. So then I moved to another restaurant they had in the same hotel, a really, really high volume La Primavera. And that's where I met my friend, best friend, Giovanni De Negris. And he's in Chicago now, Trattoria Trullo. And wonderful guy, and you know, it was just beautiful time. It was really, really intense though. We've 500-600 covers a night, and the Bulls were winning at that time too. So we would get the losing teams. We would host the team that was playing the Bulls, and they would come in late at night, and they would just be ticked off. And but I tried to take care of them as best I could. And one of the best celebs I've ever brought into my restaurant and my staff waiting on is Shaquille O'Neal. He was the most gracious guy. he would eat five, he would eat 4 to 5 bowls of fettuccine Alfredo and just sit there, and he would sign every autograph, people, all the whole restaurant. And then he'd buy the restaurant. He'd like, John, I'll take care of all of the desserts. Oh, and just, I'm like, no, I've got 5 tables waiting in the bar. No.
Well, but, no wonder everybody loves Shaq. I mean, he's, you know, he is the big teddy bear of a guy. And really, you're lucky that you got to meet him while he was still playing.
That's it. Cool. But I was like, we were watching Goodfellas once, and that scene in Goodfellas where they bring in a table and put it in front, that's me. My wife goes, that's you! That was because we had singing waiters and waitresses there, real opera singers. So that's where I met my wife. Yeah, I hired my wife. I was just a scumbag. I was asked, at the very interview, I'm like, doing my tuxedo, I'm like, so you're an opera singer? And she's like, yes.
Wow.
And I'm like, so to get to work, is there you have a car or a significant other with a car? Or?
This does sound like a scene out of the Goodfellas.
So the piano was the big thing, the big draw in the middle of the room. And I would bring my bussers out, 5 of them, and I would roll an 8 top that, you know, if you got duped really well, the guy knows you, doctor or whatever, and you roll it up. I would have them sing on the other side of the room, so everyone's like this, doing some beautiful, you know, just gorgeous singing, and I would come through the back and set this table up, and people would go back to eating after the song, and they're like, was that table there? Just like on Goodfellas, where you
magic.
Go in front. Yes.
Yeah, right.
But
so that's cool. So, but this is quite a sort of a precursor to your leap into the world of pizza. So how did that all happen?
Yes. Well, actually, after that, I went to the Oak Room. Opened the Oak Room. Copley Plaza Hotel was changing hands at the Fairmont. So I went there and I met Marcella Hazen and Julia Child. They helped us open it. They were with Sally Jackson, and she's a PR rep, best friends. And I got to meet with them, cook with them. That was really, really inspiring. But then I went to, after that, I went to Washington, D.C. to an 800-room hotel, Omni Shoreham, as director of restaurants and food and beverage director. And that was under renovation. It was then that I started realizing I was working so much. And, you know, you were only as good as the last GM that you had. Other GMs would bring in their own crews. You're out. And the pay was good, but it wasn't worth 14 to 17 hour days. And I remember one guy, this guy had come in the restaurant and I saw him and I seated him for breakfast. I seated him for lunch. And then he came at 2 p.m. and he had scones and tea. And then I realized I haven't even eaten yet. This guy's eaten 3 times. And I said, something's gotta go. So,
you know, a friend of mine, who's a chef, had been a chef in fine dining and then moved into sort of the more everyday casual type food. And I said, well, how did you make that decision to move out of fine dining? And he said, I was told by one of my mentors that if you feed the elite, you eat with the masses. But if you feed the masses, you eat with the elite. And that was what drove me. Yeah,
I love that.
It stuck with me. Like one of your nuggets.
Yes. It's like, you see the chef in the corner eating a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and just like, what's up with that chef? Just let me alone. Yeah. So then my mom lived here in Athens and she had a little thing that Little Caesars was going out of business. And so I came, we went through all the rigmarole and we decided, and all my friends said, don't do it. And I said, no, I want to get into the pizza thing. And got some great recipes from my friend Giovanni and some other chef friends that I knew. And we just started in the year 2000 in this small town, and we got a loan with no money down. And it's been a
it's
great
hard to believe
ride.
That's 20 years ago. That's a whole generation. Oh, you had a generation in fine dining, and now since then, an entire generation now in feeding the masses and eating with the elite.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So today I'm even getting guys.
I'm sorry. That explains a lot. When I look at your your website and your blog and everything, I see so much creativity and so much drawing from sort of culinary heritage, not just, you know, not just the pizza community heritage, but you know, into other roots. And that, and this background helps me to understand where a lot of that, where you're connecting the dots between those worlds and bringing a lot of really interesting culinary history, culinary technique, you know, into the realm of pizza, which is a real gift to the pizza community, especially those folks who are reading magazines like Pizza Today and seeing your creativity on display. So I really
thank
you for that and appreciate that. I really want to talk with you because we're kind of coming to the end of this first episode, but as we get into the second episode, I'd love to see like maybe a little something that you've created, but talk some about some of the things you're working with, like Kernza, for instance, this wheat related grain that is coming back, starting to come back. And I think that you're, you know, having a hand in that, and some of the other really cool things that you've made both at Avalanche Pizza, and I'm not sure how much of what I read is showing up on the menu at the restaurant and how much is just stuff you're doing for fun, but I'd love to hear more about it. I see you at the Pizza and Pasta show in Atlantic City doing pasta demos. So, you know, you've not only doing pizza, do you do pasta at the restaurant?
Nope. No, we don't do, it's too busy to pour it, but we do cater a lot of catering with pastas and homemade pastas and stuff.
Clearly, pasta, you know, courses, clearly there's some passion and love in that sector for you as well.
Yeah.
So if you could bring all of our, you know, of our viewers just up to date, then when you made the leap over, and you about 20 years ago, that's when you opened your first place. Is that now Avalanche, or was that something before that?
That was Avalanche. I was going to name it Plague Pizza. I wanted to have these, like, everyone in black robes and, you answer the phone and say, can I have a Grim Reaperoni, please? And stuff like that. And that would have been, but my wife said, no, I want to put rats in the window, you know, like rubber rats. And that wouldn't have gone over well.
Now you could even have people wearing those masks with the long noses on the show. And
that's
on CNN, you know, the medical masks, you know, of the 17th century, the last plague.
That's so right.
you were 20 years ahead of yourself on that idea.
Right. Well, we were into it from 2000, and about 2004, we started going with PMQ to compete, okay? And that's when I first met Tony Gemignani, and he was doing the acrobatics then. And Big Dave Ostrander, God rest his soul, the greatest guy in the world.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, that gentleman was, you know, Joe Carlucci, Bruno DeFabio, all these guys. So we competed for a while. We won, actually, Bryn, my general manager at the time, Bryn Humphreys. I guess she's now a producer at Second City in Chicago.
Really?
She won. I took a Godzilla. We did our Godzilla pizza. So we did a workup on it. We did rings of the spinach and then a feta. And then in the middle had some sun-dried tomatoes. Beautiful pizza. So Bryn got dressed up in... This is when you, the World Pizza, this is when you did a show. Like, Sean Browser was there, and he got dressed up as Rocky. And he's like, no, I'm Apollo Creed. I'm like, you look more like Rocky. So they would play the Rocky theme song, and the crowd went crazy, and he presented his pizza. So when we got up there, I had a Godzilla, this 3x3 foot Godzilla head, and a Godzilla costume that could, and with the eyes, and we played Blue Oyster Cult, Go, Go, Godzilla. And Bryn presented her pizza. She was totally hungover. She looked green with green sequins.
That was your entrance music, was the Godzilla.
That's right. And it was so much fun. And she won. So we won that year. And then I kept competing in Italy almost every year. It changed. I went to the World Pizza Champions, and it ended up being just me, Bruno DeFabio, and Tony. And that was really, really fun. Justin Wadstein, oh my gosh. I got to say this. Justin is like the best of the best pizza people I've ever met in my life. You know, he called me back. He was doing acrobatics, and I'd seen him on I'd seen him do a chair over his head just and freak people out. But he's like, John, out back in the alley. And I'm like, what? And he had this board. And he was nailing this beautiful 400 thread count towel to it. And he had a diesel fuel. And I'm like, what the? what are you doing, Justin? He's like, this is my act. I'm going to make an inverted tornado. And I'm like, you're going to burn the place down. And so I helped him, and me and Joe Carlucci, and we lit it up. And it was a huge board too. It was about 2.5 by 2.5. And he just kept going. And Heinz Beck, the chef, was right there and the fire department was there too, the fire chief. And sure enough, that thing turned into an inverted tornado of fire. And I'll never forget that.
I wish we had video of that. Were you also competing in the acrobatic side, or were you doing more of the...
No, I was too old. Too old. Just did the pizzas. I did all of the things in 2006. I think I got the highest score in Napolitana. And even though I had a hole in my pizza, but you know what? The mozzarella saved me. It just, I put it on the plate. I'm like, hole. And then the mozzarella just went right over the hole. And I'm like,
right.
Because it was beautiful.
Where is Justin these days? Is he still in the game?
Yes. He's got a really great place out in California, and he's making pizza, some beautiful pies now. And
well, yes. When we come back, I want to find out a little bit more about sort of first the origin of the name Avalanche Pizza for you guys, which I'm sure there's a little story there, and talk a little bit about some of the forward-thinking things that you're doing, the things you're thinking about in terms of the future of pizza, and take a look at maybe something that you've made as well.
Stick around for more Pizza Quest after a word from our sponsor.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 35 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on an eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail served on the beautiful patio, which has ample room for social distancing. Travelers from around the world find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
We're with John Gutekunst. We're just continuing our conversation, having a lot of fun. John is in Athens, Ohio at Avalanche Pizza, but also we're recounting some of the days on the World Pizza Champions team. When you guys competed against and really, like, you were the outsiders coming in, and I'm sure the Italians didn't appreciate the sort of swagger that you guys, the Americans, brought with them. But you did pretty well. You won some championships, and really helped launch, I think, here in America, this booming interest in not just the sort of the theatrical side of pizza, but also the quality of pizza just started expanding. And I think we brought back to tell me if I'm wrong, because you've been over there more than me. The Americans brought over to them the sense that almost anything's possible on top of a pizza, and expanded their thinking about that. Would you say that kind of happened, a little reciprocation there?
Totally, totally. In fact, I've got a story about Bruno and Tony and I and Justin, and it won the Best Food Writing 2012, and it's about me. I thought we'd go over there, and I'd be like, oh yeah, and then I'll go to the store and buy some truffles. But it became this like mafia type drug deal in the mountains that turned into, at the same time, Bruno was doing the fastest. I mean, I've never seen anyone faster than him, and he's won so many times, and doing the fastest pizza. And it just all melded together. Tony, Justin saying, you know, are you sure you want to go in there? I don't know. We walked into this back of this place, and everyone stopped. It was just like, oh my gosh. But I finally got the truffles, the Bianchetto truffles from that area. And I don't think I won. One of the judges, he came up to me. I paired it with scallops, diver scallops, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
And he came up to me and he goes, Josef, he's just German. Josef on with the scallop on a pizza, seafood, no. I'm like, well, so you didn't score me high then, right? I'm like, you piece of crap. You're wearing an ascot, okay? Who wears an ascot? And they're pulling me off of him. I'm just like, you're like Rock Hudson, man, but only like 40 years too late. But your whole trick goes.
The judges always were looking for a way to bust Americans' chops back then. Oh, you know, if they could bust you on anything, they would.
Tony told us some stories about, you know, he told, I don't even think we got it on the taped interview with him, but when he told me one time where they, you know, when he was competing for that margarita championship, and one of the judges told him that the box he was using was all wrong, that he was mixing in something that wasn't legal. And Tony said, no, it is. And he actually corrected the judge who was about to disqualify him when another judge came and basically told the first judge to step back because Tony's right and you're wrong. So, you know, it's kind of like this up in there. But when you started Avalanche, how did you even get the name Avalanche? Where did that come from?
Well, I wanted to do something different as usual, but I wanted to have a ton of toppings. Okay. So we started with 28 toppings. I think we're up to 80 now. Lord knows, kimchi. I make kimchi every week. It's one of our most popular toppings. It paired with provolone cheese. I even get these, I don't say hillbillies, these rural people, like an old rural guy came in. He's like, oh yeah, give me that Chinese cabbage on a, just a cheese of provolone and Chinese cabbage. And I'm like, well, it's up, coming right up. But, you know, it is just amazing. And now I started about 15 years ago, just going all local. And so we have local pork, local chicken, local beef now. We make our own sausage. There's no nitrates in our sausage. We get it in tubes, and it's a simple mix, and people love it. You can just literally taste the difference. It's just the vegetables all summer long we get are all local. So that, to me, when right now we're having a hard time finding cheese, actually. The same cheese that we use, the quality cheeses, are gone. I don't know what's happening with the whole system now. But
Hopefully that's going to correct itself soon, we hope. But
yes,
you have done some really unique, interesting things. Again, I don't know how much of this shows up on the menu, but on your blog, I see some really cool things. You made something called a slagle. Is that what it was? Am I getting that right?
A snagle.
What is a snagle? It looks like a bagel on the outside, but it's got something going on inside, yes. Right?
Well, we took some pizza dough, and I wanted to. So I put everything in there. We've got smoked salmon, capers, red onions, cream cheese, and that's it. And we rolled it up into a snake, okay? And at first I did a snake, but then I'm like, hey, we could make this into a giant bagel. So I put it together and let it proof, popped it in some water with cornstarch, and, you know, it came out. And then I put everything toppings on it. So it was an everything bagel. So
you boiled it like a bagel, though. You treated it like a bagel, then you baked it off with everything topping.
It was so
in a way, the inside almost looks like a little bit like a stromboli in a way, kind of a rolled up and filled in. So it's a bagel, stromboli, everything bagel thing.
Baked off in the oven.
Did you actually sell those or did you just make them for
Fun? We sell them. I've got the best conditions ever for anything innovative, and it's our farmer's market. We have one of the 10 best farmer's markets in the country. So I go down, I usually bake with Joel Fair and I, and Chris sometimes. We bake from about 9 o'clock at night on Friday night till about 9 in the morning. And I go over with 400 some odd pieces of breads, pizzas, et cetera. And we sell out in an hour and a half. So that's our creative juice that runs that. And it's become this kind of a cult following, but people will eat anything I do, anything I make, because they know I'm using the best ingredients. So we started doing, like the chicken schmaltz laminated breads and stuff. I did oh my God, this thing was so great. I made a gnocchi, a giant gnocchi. And I wanted, and Joel's like, John, you're going to, I'm like, no, this is great. Cause I have potato in this dough. It's really hydrated, nice and puffy. So I took it. I got a pot of water going together, with malt inside it. And I wanted to put the strips in it like a gnocchi. And then I took the, when you use pans, you have to have a raised metal thing on your make line. You've seen those, okay? So I took that and took the dough and just went like that, and it created the perfect gnocchi. I had the perfect underlayment, popped it in there, and then I baked them off. It was really cool, huge gnocchi.
So how big was the gnocchi? It was still a giant gnocchi when it came out?
Yes, it was giant.
It was a Godzilla gnocchi.
Yeah, it was. And because I boiled it, it didn't lose its form, which sometimes is tough to do when you're trying to make something. Like, I've been trying to mimic pastas, and it's a little tough. I did one here. It's a kreshtayat, which is, I don't know if you can see that. It's a pasta type that David Marcelli and Buca, restaurant Buca, I believe he works for. He does all their pastas. So this was on with the old lady pasta ladies, pasta grannies. Okay, they make this, and it's usually made with leftover polenta, and it's formed into a triangle. Oh, here, I've got this. So I'll show you this. So it's formed into a triangle like this. It's made with leftover polenta. You take the middles and bring them together like that, okay? So, and then you go under.
Is the polenta in the dough? Is it a dough made with polenta?
Yes. No, this doesn't, but the pasta usually has polenta in the dough. I couldn't manipulate it that well. So, and then you bring this over, and you make sure you have a lot of flour there. And I par-bake this, and this kind of puffs up like that. And then I'll bring it up, and then I add the cheese to it, and I have these duck lardo meatballs that I pop on top of that. And it just pops up just like you would get from David's restaurant.
So it's a beautiful little handheld... almost a sandwichy.
Got everything.
Yeah.
So very cool. But I love doing those things and just trying to, it's mostly out of boredom, but you know, I get people saying, God, how many drugs did you do in the 70s? What are you talking about?
I mean, as soon as you tell them you can't remember, then they know that you were there.
That's right.
You've mentioned sort of, again, moving like the whole farm-to-table movement. You're using local as much as possible. But what about some of these heirloom grains that you're incorporating now into your work?
Yes, really excited.
What specifically are the ones that...
Well, we're getting some... A local mill has red fife every now and then. That's really cool. But the biggest one that we've started on and is Kernza. And you can see this is Kernza. Kernza is a perennial wheatgrass, okay? And it roots go, Wes Jackson at the Land Institute, he's the greatest guy ever. His big forte is we are ruining our whole world with this plowing, constant plowing, the dust, the fertilizer, everything we use. So perennials are really big. And one of these roots go down about 10 to 15 feet. They hold nitrogen in the soil. And it's a really tall plant.
Yeah.
And it's tough because of the, we've started making stuff with it. They've made beer with it. And I went to a symposium and they were only using 20% Kernza. They're using some of it. Now we do a very thin crust pizza. This is beautiful. And I don't know, you guys out there who have ever done dough, and this is just with a Gruyere on here, because Kernza has this cool crunch. It has more protein in it, but less gluten than flour. So, and it has a lot of bran in it too. So it makes it a little tough to.
So it's a whole grain that you're using there, the whole grain Kernza. And is that 100% Kernza, the one you're holding up right now?
No, this is 50% Kernza and 50% Manitoba wheat, which is all Trump's. But the problem with this is 20% hydration. And if you've ever done 20%, tried to knead 20, you'll look like Popeye. And you do that a few times a week. And,
because why? It doesn't hold water? Is that the reason?
Oh, it doesn't. Yeah. But, you know, time is everything. So this is, it's like almost like a really dry pasta when you get it out. So we have to use the sheeter. And we waste a lot, too, because we have to cut it into the perfect circle. But, man, at 600 degrees... That crisp, look at that. It's just.
Wow.
Just gorgeous.
And a very distinctive flavor, a flavor that's different from wheat, even though it's in the wheat family.
Yeah. It's got a neat back end. It's almost minty, like shiso. You ever have shiso in Japan? I ate a lot of shiso. And it's a cool thing. But the problem was General Mills. Okay, General Mills owns Cascadian Farms. They're one of the biggest organic companies in the world. So they bought, I don't know how many million acres of Kernza because they freaked out. Kernza makes the best puffed wheat berries. They're a lot smaller than wheat, but the taste is so beautiful that they flipped out and they bought all this Kernza. So I couldn't get any on the market from the organic.
They're using it. They're hoarding it all for their own products. So they're using it in puff wheat cereals and things like that.
Yes.
Very interesting. Because I know that Kernza is, Kernza is one of those things that's about to tip over. You heard it here first if you haven't heard it already. And I also want to just step back one point and give a shout out to Wes Jackson, who's really one of the heroes of the environmental movement. I've been tracking Wes for about 40 years since he first started publishing. He's been so instrumental in saving seeds and saving the environment, saving the land. So anybody who's interested in the environment, you should be looking him up. And where did you say that he is now?
He's at the Land Institute in Kansas. And there's stories. He would just take 2 6-foot tables and put them down when he would talk to farmers and put a black tablecloth. And he actually grew Kernza in a tube. Actually, it kept growing. And he put formaldehyde on it and washed it off. And he would throw the Kernza down and show these farmers that the roots, how far the roots went. And instantly they knew that. Yeah. This plant has roots. So it goes about, I've been working with OSU Worcester, a professor up there, and he is an amazing guy. And he's got me the flower. So it's been fun.
Well, on your Pizza Goon blog, there's a picture of you showing the root of the Kernza next to or behind you, standard wheat roots that only go down about, a fraction of the length into the soil. So basically, the Kernza is perennial. They don't have to keep reseeding it. You're right there, it just replenishes itself. So what's the downside? There's no downside.
Except
it doesn't make gluten. It makes it's high protein, but not gluten protein. Is that correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it's just a matter of figuring out all the different ways you can use it, and you're already starting to do that and doing a flatbread with it. Are you using it in anything else?
I'm incorporating in with breads now since we've got another load. So Star Trek head. It's very weird. I added maple syrup. So these farmers give me all sorts of stuff that I have to use. So one farmer gave me fermented maple syrup. Klingon head. I did a Klingon head mega batard this weekend. So it was sweet and it's Kernza. And I cut 2 holes in the end of the batard and cut this, and it looks like a Klingon's forehead. So it was fun, but it was 100% semolina underneath. So it's savory semolina, and you've got the sweet Klingon on top, and that was fun.
Klingon? Are you a Star Trek fan, or was it just an image that came to you when you did it?
I just like weird names because I'm right there when people are buying it. They're going, "What? Children of the Corn?" And that was a batard that I wrapped in. I filled it with corn and everything, and then I wrapped it back into the corn the corn outside, the skins, and baked it off. So, but I've had some pretty weird. A hobo sack. I did a hobo sack pizza, which is cool. You just, you put everything inside, and then you bring up the 4 ends. And that came out of necessity. When I do a lot of baking, I'll do blobs, what I call blobs. I'll create the sourdough. I put them on a sheet pan, cover them with plastic, pop them in the oven, age it for 2 days, and then I lay it out like a ciabatta on a stainless steel table, and I can cut squares out of that. So the squares, I take each part of that, tie it together. It looks like a hobo sack. Remember the old hobos where they had the stick in the sack? So.
Or sometimes what do they call them, a bride's purse or something like that.
Yes.
So they're like purses. So they're filled almost like, like a little pocket pizza or a calzone in a sense.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, this is the problem. You're dangerous because you've got a classic background in culinary. Yeah. You've got this sort of wild pizza experience with the pizza world team going over to Italy and getting crazy over there. And then you've got this imagination. And essentially what that means is pretty much anything you think of, you can find a way to make it happen. And now
it's fun, and no one's stopping me. That's the problem. There lies the problem.
Well, I'm sure that that's part of your wife's job, right?
That's right. She's like, are you sure you want to do that, John? That's usually
rein him in.
Don't do it.
But we're glad that you're kind of, you know, unleashed, because your creativity, you know, gets shared, you know, through your writings. You know, you are an award-winning writer. You've written for Gastronomica, one of the great culinary journals. You've done everything.
Yeah, that was fun.
And so, you know, all I can say is I appreciate it. I always look forward to seeing you at the expos and the New Jersey, what is it, Pizza and Pasta Northeast.
Yes.
Hopefully I'll get back to Ohio sometime. I'd love to get you back on another time.
Cool.
One thing that maybe we can just touch on today and carry it the next time.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, that, but also one of the things I noticed about Ohio as a state is that it's really a hotbed for creativity in the pizza sector. There's a lot of competitors that have come out of Ohio. Maybe the first winners that the American teams have had were all seem to be from Ohio pizzerias. And I'm just wondering if any thoughts about what it is about Ohio that has sort of allowed it to be this incubator for creativity in the pizza sector.
People are really, they love pizza here in Ohio. They just love pizza. You know, I remember back way back when where they had judges at the, in Columbus, and they were showing them the Boboli crust as a marker, as a measurement for the perfect crust. And it blew my mind, you know. And back then I used to compete, and they're like, well, that prosciutto you had on there, it was put on cold after the oven. You didn't cook it? And I was like, whoa. but it's gotten a lot better, and the competitors have gotten so good.
Well, you guys had one of the early competition shows in Ohio too, right? With the ice cream and pizza show.
Yes. Uh-huh. So and the Napix and stuff. But now I'm just open to anything. And you know, that's what I love about emceeing at the Pizza Expo. It is such a great competition now, and I learned so much. And it's those little things. These judges, like Domenico Crolla, he knows so much stuff that you can't get anything over on him. Especially,
Website, his Instagrams and websites are kind of like, again, mind blowing.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And well,
it's just even knowing like. The Vacca Rossa, like Parmesan. You don't just say Parmesan. No, I've got the Vacca Rossa, which is the red cow, the old type of Parmesan from the red cow. This is, you know, that kind of stuff really rings, gets you some good points.
Well, we're running out of time, so we're going to definitely have to have you back to continue this conversation. but I did want to mention something. My producer, Jeff, tells me that the ascot is coming back. So that German judge wearing the ascot gave me grief.
It was purple paisley ascot too, man. I mean, if there's any ascot, mega ascot, that was a mega ascot.
Well, those of you, if you see anyone wearing a purple paisley ascot, you'll know that it's coming full circle from 20 years ago when the judge gave John grief in the competition. But Don, thank you so much.
All right.
Thank you so much for being a part of Pizza Talk. Thanks for coming on, showing us some of your work. People that want to follow John, you've got your own blog. You're still doing – I know you haven't been doing blogging as much on the Pizza Goon, but are you doing Instagram or where are you?
Instagram a lot,
Showcasing most of your stuff.
J Gudekants, just J-G-U-T-E-K-N-S. Or Facebook, you can try and friend me. And, so that's all good.
And hopefully I'll see you in Atlantic City in October at the Northeast Pizza and Pasta Show, God willing.
Yes.
And again, John Gudekants, thank you so much for being part
of I'm honored. I'm
today.
Really honored.
Visit
Peter.
The Avalanche. My pleasure and my honor as well. So thank you. And thank you all for joining us. We'll see you at the next episode of Pizza Talk. Thanks.
Thanks.
Pizza Quest is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org, and connect with us on Instagram and Twitter @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization
driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Thanks for listening.